Welcome to PRN's Progressive Radio News Hour. I'm Steve Lindman. It is great to have John Cozy back again. John, it has been so long. My listeners have missed you. I've missed you. I hope you're well. I hope we're ready for a rousing hour of discussion. And John, on the one hand, I could say we have a lot of catching up to do. Maybe we can talk about your two most recent articles. The one, the second from the latest, you call Talking Trash, War, Economic Crisis, and the Lies of History. And the most recent one you call Expendable People. Can we begin with Talking Trash? I like to just say, I like to just use the old-fashioned word lying. Can I give you one example? It's right out of the headlines today, which is the only reason I mention it. From the Wall Street Journal, John, this morning, it says, job strength puts Fed on hot seat. Jobs strength. Are they talking about America, John, or are they talking about some other country? I don't know about any job strength in America, so I would call that talking trash, lying, anything you want to call it. And I'll back it up with some evidence. John Williams, an economist who calculates the correct unemployment number based on the way it was calculated in the 1980s, before they started messing up the model, manipulating it to make things look a lot better than they really are, even though the Labor Department says, I forget the precise number, the number that they release every month, the first Friday of every month, unless it's a holiday, then they'll pick another day. The number they release is plus or minus a huge differential. It could be several hundred thousand difference. So if they tell you 100,000 jobs were created, maybe a couple of 100,000 or 300,000 were lost. I mean, you just never know based on the way their formula goes. And it's a very strange system they use. It certainly isn't accurate. So, and then to talk about job strength, well, we can talk about that a little bit more. But John Williams, in his latest number, with this number that was about 200,000 compared to maybe 150 or so in recent reports, John Williams, for the last couple of months before the latest report, had America's unemployment rate at 23.3%. His latest calculation based on the 1980s model, John, it went up. The unemployment rate went up during the job strength that the Wall Street Journal talks about. He's clocked it at 23.5.
Yeah, well, you know, Steve, all of these measures are statistical measures that are bad. Every one of them, whether it's unemployment or consumer confidence or GDP or anything else, the numbers really don't tell you anything. First of all, statistics, you know, change depending on how they're accumulated, and then they change depending on how the what's accumulated is interpreted, and simple measures that people don't understand, like averages, don't really tell us anything. For instance, you take an average of a column of numbers of 10 numbers, the average will come out to be something or other, and then you simply increase the top number by half, and the average goes up. You know, but people don't know that. And there's also an error ratio in a statistical average. The error rate for employment in a month is more than 900,000, plus or minus more than 900,000. You know, so if they say that it went up 30,000 and the plus or minus 900,000, it doesn't do anything at all. But they don't tell people that. Even the gross domestic product has a range of error that they don't tell anybody about. It's the whole thing is a scandal. I mean, it's just just meaningless talk. I use the term talking trash because it's a little bit different than just telling lies, although trash is a lie, of course. But we change the meaning of words and we begin to use the words in ways that make no sense whatsoever, but we think we're still talking about something that makes sense.
John, so an example you give is, for example, saying the economy is expanding, quote-unquote.
Well, yeah, the president said that yesterday, and that's nonsense. Of course, the economy is supposed to be expanding. They tell you that the employment force is only 62% working. Only 62% of the workforce is working, and that's supposed to be expanding. You see that it's not that the economy is expanding. It's GDP that's expanding. But GDP is an average number that has an error rate, and like I pointed out just a minute ago, you know, you take an average of 10, a column of 10 numbers, and then you increase the top number by half, and the average goes up, and the other nine numbers stay the same. So that, you know, it doesn't tell you anything at all about what's going on. It's a whole thing's a scam. But how we talk trash and change the language to make it look like we're saying something when we're not might be best exemplified by the use of the word intelligence in our intelligence community. Well, you know, just think about it for a minute. The word intelligence has always meant a mental attribute that some people have. You know, and what they're talking about is not a mental attribute. They're talking about information, and information, of course, can be false. And then they talk about bad intelligence. So now you transpose back that to the original meaning of intelligence. You see, he's an intelligent man, and somebody says, "Yeah, his intelligence is bad." I mean, what kind of sense does that make? It doesn't make any sense at all. But people think it does. Talking about the economy is nonsense. We don't know anything about the economy. We don't even know what the economy is. People in other countries talk about the underground economy as well as the legal economy. Well, which is the economy? I mean, is the underground economy part of the economy or not? I mean, nobody in America asks these questions. Nobody wants to think about it.
Of course, John.
We talk about the economy as buying and selling in the store, or on the stock market or something. We don't talk about buying and selling in yard sales or garage sales. We don't talk about the money made by burglars when they steal. Why not? That's an economic activity. We don't talk about the money made by drug dealers. That's an economic activity. They do it to make money. I mean, the word the economy is absolutely meaningless word. It has no meaning whatsoever. No denotation. Nobody can tell us what's involved in the economy. One would think that, you know, any activity that it results in the making of money in some sense or other would be part of the economy, but so many of them are left out of what economists talk about as the economy that it's nonsense.
It really is not such a... If 62% of the workforce is working, my definition of the workforce would mean the number of people who wish to work, and if only 60-odd percent of them are able to find jobs, to me that reflects a dismal state of what anybody wants to call the economy. And as far as any individual is concerned, the word certainly has no meaning at all. The only thing that means anything to them is, are they earning enough income to be able to pay the rent, to feed their families, to send their kids to school, to take care of normal expenses, medical and otherwise? That's the only thing that has any meaning for them. And that sort of information, individual by individual, household by household, doesn't show up in any economic statistics. And again, as you've said, John, these numbers are absolutely meaningless. And the fact that they're manipulated and rigged, besides, they're really meaningless. They'd be meaningless if they really were very close to being accurate in terms of measuring the overall scope of things. But the fact that they are so manipulated and corrupted, they literally have no meaing whatsoever.
Yeah, and really, all economic talk is that way. When economists talk about anything, they talk in that kind of generalized way that never specifies the meaning of the nouns that they use, especially the collective nouns that they use. Take, for instance, the second alternative, the second article you referred to, the last one I wrote. I really wanted to talk about the first one, the one before the ones you mentioned. But that's all right.
Well, we can talk about that, too.
Western economists, English economists, and that's, English brood economists, have only ever been apologizing or rationalizing for the corrupt activities of the British economy in the 12th century or 16th century or whenever. People talk about, the Republicans wanting to cut the social safety net in America. Actually, they want to destroy it. And then you meant talking about globalization. Well, in economic theory, English economic theory, wages gravitate toward a subsistence level. And the reason it gravitated toward a subsistence level is that the English wanted to maintain and reproduce labor force. They needed a labor force, so they treated it like cows in a barnyard. You feed them and you keep them housed, and they have offspring, and they keep the thing going, and that's all that labor is. It's beast of burden labor theory. And then I pointed out that globalization comes along and companies find their labor in underdeveloped countries, in Bangladesh or China or somewhere. Then the American the domestic workforce isn't needed at all. You don't need to maintain it. You don't need to reproduce it. You might just as well destroy it. Which is what the Republicans want to do. Of course, they want the American labor force to disappear. Then you don't have to take care of them. You don't have to feed them. You don't have to give them health care. You don't have to pay them Social Security or old age pensions or whatever. Just get rid of them. Just like we would, old horses. We send them to the glue factory. And that's what's going on. And it's part of economic theory. It is distinctly related to the writings of the classical economists, and these our economists who claim that they're scientists, it's a joke. It's a religious ideology, and it's not good for humanity, no matter how you cut it. These people are. Somebody objected to this in a comment that I got in an email from the article. He's objected to my calling economists evil. He said that doesn't come to anything. Only makes people mad. Yeah, it makes people mad, but calling them anything else doesn't do anything at all. They just ignore it. So you have to realize that even guys like Paul Krugman, Krugman is really what his name is. Who are called themselves liberal economists, they're evil people because they support these things, these principles that have these horrid consequences, and they think they can ameliorate the consequences by, well, Keynesians' ideas of governmental intervention and safety net and that sort of thing. You can't fix evil. I mean, if once you permit evil, evil is evil, and it's not going to get any better by giving a hungry man isn't going to be made any better by giving a cracker. I mean, you know, it's face reality. We won't do it in America. We simply will not do it, and it angers me. And it's not just the economists, the whole structure of power. The whole power structure has ways of defending itself. I give you an example. There was a show on NBC, I guess it's called, about fraud in America. And there was this one show, one program, in which one fraudster was identified who built people millions of dollars. And he got wind that they were going to come looking for him, so he took off and hid. And he was finally discovered in Connecticut. And they got a Florida judge to ask that he be arrested. They took the arrest warrant to Connecticut, and a Connecticut judge refused to authorize it because it wasn't a Connecticut problem. And he let the fraudster go. Of course, by the time they got another kind of warrant, the fraudster was hidden again. He took off and secreted himself somewhere else in the world, and I don't know where. Nobody knows where. But here it is, you know, a judge prevents the capture of a fraudster. And in that whole one-hour show, not one mention of the judge's name took place. You know, so how are you going to correct, you know, evildoers if you don't name them? And it happens all the time. It happens in newspapers, even local newspapers. You know, a judge will issue some sort of a decision and let somebody off on a light sentence or something, and he goes and commits another crime right away. Okay, and is arrested again. Nobody mentions the judge's name who let the guy off. That's part of protecting the status quo.
John, that bugs me especially because I comment on cases in court, and sometimes an article, including in the New York Times, will merely say, not the judge by name, but the court ruled.
Yeah.
The court ruled? Well, yeah. The court didn't rule anything. I mean, a human being sat at the bench in that court, and that human being made the ruling. So what's the guy's name or the woman's name? Well, sometimes they tell you and sometimes they don't, but I like to give the name of the person I talk about it in my article, but the only way I can find out is if somebody mentioned it, and if they bury the name, and if nobody mentions it, I don't have any idea who sat in that courtroom, but that annoys me greatly.
Yeah, that's another instance of talking trash. You know, instead of talking, you use a figure of speech. Instead of naming the judge, you use the word the court. You know, which doesn't tell you anything except that you know that a judge did it, but you don't know which judge it is. That's talking trash. That's a meaningless statement. And I was hot about that today. I wrote that article, I guess the most prominent comment I got about that article was nobody really cares.
I certainly care.
You know, that's true. Nobody really cares.
In your most recent article, you ended with a statement I consider very important, and I'll just quote you. You say, quote, "If the human race is to survive, the welfare of human beings must be the goal of human institutions." I can't imagine anything much more important than that. I mean, if we don't protect human beings, then there won't be any humanity left. So we won't have to worry about anything. And if there's no humanity left, you know, they can substitute machines for people, companies, to get the cost down to as low as zero as possible. You know, just the inanimate production inputs will be the only cost, but there'll be nobody around to buy the stuff they make.
Yeah, I you know, it's kind of shows the idiocy of the Industrial Revolution. You know, Henry Ford realized that he had to give people a higher wage that made his cars, otherwise they couldn't buy them.
Exactly.
And now we're getting to the point we're going to be able to print cars on 3D printers. We're already printing guns on, you know, three guns that work on 3D printers. So, you know, all right, so you print all these cars and all these guns, and you don't have any employees whatsoever, you know, who are we going to sell them to? I don't know. It's idiotic. I mean, you know, it doesn't take that much to realize that a long time ago, in one of my classes, I remember, I was teaching in North Carolina at the time, and they were moving textile plants from North Carolina to Latin America. And I said, yeah, okay, it's going to result in cheaper textiles for Americans that have jobs. But if Americans who don't have jobs aren't going to be buying cheaper textiles, they're not going to be buying any textiles at all. And you know, it's obvious. You can't do it. I mean, the money in an economy like ours, which is a terrible economy, it's like the circulation of blood in the body. You know, if the money doesn't circulate, doesn't get to the people who can use it to buy with, then nobody can buy the products being made that investors are investing in. So it's a simple matter to understand, but nobody thinks about it.
Nobody does, John. Paul Craig Roberts comes on this program an awful lot. A key theme that he revisits often, and he does it in, I think, his newest article, he talks about, it's literally a crime of offshoring U.S. jobs. Manufacturing jobs, America's manufacturing base has really been decimated, even though there's a fair amount left because America is the world's largest economy. But so much of America's manufacturing base and many other jobs, high-paying and not so high-paying, have been offshore to low-wage countries. And Paul Craig Roberts calls this a greater crime than terrorism. Well, the only terrorism I call a great crime is what I call state terrorism. There isn't very much of the other kind around. There certainly is none in America, despite all the hype about people being arrested for this or that or whatever. But it's all made up because these people committed no crimes whatsoever. There are two of them.
Yeah, Paul Craig Roberts has written some interesting pieces in recent days. But I always get a lump in my throat when I read his stuff. He was part of the Reagan administration. And he never said anything about the damage that Reagan did to the economy and the way we think about it in America.
I've said a fair amount about it, John. A few years ago, it was close to his centennial, the centennial date of his birth. And I wrote a very long article. I just went back and I tried to cover his record rather extensively, and it really has an awful lot in it that certainly would be nothing you or I would be proud of,
no,
to put it mildly.
Yeah, and so you know, and Paul Craig Roberts, and you know, writes things, but he never associates them with any kind of theory or ideological view. He's never pointed out, for instance, like what I did, that the subsistence theory of wages implies that if you don't need a workforce, you don't need labor, get rid of them entirely.
I guess you can't cover all the topics, John. I sure don't. I try to cover an awful lot of them, but it's impossible to cover them all. And if I stop and think and make a list, I could come up with a good number of things that I either have really written anything about or have never written anything at all.
Oh, yeah. I mean, most of the stuff, you know, people write about, I don't write about. I wouldn't think about writing about it because I'm not an insider. I don't have any inside information about any of it, and neither do most of the people who write about things.
Oh, I certainly am not an insider.
But you know, it's the same old story that newspapers face. If you want to be read, you gotta come up with something topical. And you know, it's great to, which gets me back to my first article that I really wanted to talk about.
Okay.
You know, I got the article, the idea for that article by thinking about the Zimmerman trial in Florida the Martin killing.
Yeah.
And it occurred to me that, you know, he got off because of the way the prosecution framed the event. They framed the event as beginning when Martin confronted Zimmerman after being stalked. And if you conceive of the event as beginning at that moment, then of course Martin was the aggressor. But you know, you really should have framed that article as beginning when Zimmerman decided to follow Martin in the first place, which the police told him wasn't necessary. And in that case, it's pretty clear that Zimmerman was the aggressor. So how do you frame a situation depends on how you think about it. And then I began to, apply that to other things, like, consider Iran, for instance. Americans nowadays frame that relationship as beginning when the Iranians took over the American embassy during the Carter administration. You know, but it really, if you want to think about the relationship we have with Iran, you have to think about it as beginning when we aided the British in the overthrow of the Mossadegh government, duly elected democratic government. And if you think about it, then we're really the ones that are aggressive toward Iran, and Iran is not aggressive toward anybody.
Well, that's exactly right, John. And for listeners who don't know the data, that was 1953.
Yeah.
It wasn't 1979. It was 1953, and that's exactly right. The most popular leader in the country at the time, Mohammad Mossadegh, and the CIA and Britain conspired to get rid of him because he had the audacity, John, to think that Iran had a right to control its own oil.
Well, yeah. You know, and then, you know, I began to think about it in terms of the war on terror, our war on terror, famous worldwide war on terror. And I said to myself, wait a minute, you know, wasn't it the papacy in something like the 11th century or 10th century that decided to send crusaders to the Middle East? You know, that the war on terror today, it's nothing but an extension of the centuries-old war on Islam that was started by Western Christians, and it's still going on. Whoops.
John?
Yeah, I got a dial tone there.
I don't know what that is. Maybe my studio will alert me if we are not on the air. I mean, I can hear you, John.
Yeah, I can hear you now.
And you can hear me.
Yeah.
If
but
my
anyhow,
studio would alert me in case my listeners can't hear anything, I'd like to know. Or alert me that my listeners can hear us both talking, John, but continue.
Okay. My point was that, you know, how you frame an issue depends on how you look at it. And if you don't frame it accurately, you don't get an accurate view of it. And the war on terror isn't a war on terror. It's a war on Islam. That's all it is. It's been, and we've been fighting it for centuries. Westerners have been fighting it for centuries. I mean, and it's kind of ridiculous that the discussions with Iran that are going on in Geneva are taking place, between four really Western countries in Iran. I mean, what chance has Iran in that kind of discussion? Britain, France, Germany, United States, and Russia. What business do they have trying to tell Iran what to do? I mean, nobody had any such discussions with Israel about him telling them what they have to do. No, because the placement of Israel in the Middle East at the end of the Second World War was itself an extension of this age-old war against Islam. You come up with all the biblical justifications whatsoever for returning Jews to their rightful homeland, and even Jews don't think it was their rightful homeland. But we have that going on, and we've stuck Israel in the Middle East. Why? We could have stuck it somewhere. You could have given it to Bavaria. You could have given Bavaria to the Jews, which would have been a more just way of doing things.
John,
we stuck them in the Middle East. Why? Yeah, I hear them, fat lady. I was just going to say, we stuck them in the Middle East because it's, war on Islam. It's been that way forever.
And all that oil, John, we need to take a break. Hold your thought. We'll come right back. We can even bring Israel into this discussion. I certainly write an awful lot on that topic. We will be right back. Welcome back, talking with John Cozy. John, in 1945, when World War II ended, of course, Israel wasn't quite Israel yet. It took a few more years before that happened, just about 3 years to the month when Hitler went down, around May of 1945, and then the Japanese a few months after that. But it was important for Israel. One thing that most people don't know about, I read a book that covered this in great detail some years back, that Israel really needed a Holocaust during World War II, number one, as a pretext for being able to say we need a state for Jews, and number two, even more important, well, you have to have a state. That certainly is most important, but after that, or maybe right along with it, is the ability to attract mainly Eastern European Jews to want to leave a place that was their natural home and want to move to the desert. Well, of course, there were people living there. The notion that Israel promulgates and still does about a land for people, a land without people for a people without land. What rubbish. Talk about trash talk, John. There were plenty of people living there for millennia. But, of course, that's another story altogether. And even before they were called Palestinians, they were called Bedouins, called whatever. But thousands of years, I mean, there were people living there, numbers small compared to today. But how on earth do you attract people? How could you take people... How do you get them back on the farm after they've seen Paris? Well, the reverse of that. How do you get people, I wouldn't call Eastern Europe Paris necessarily, even at peace, but how do you get people who are living there in something they're so used to, spent their whole lives there, and get them to want to move to the desert? Well, the only way to get them to want to do it is to scare the bejesus out of them, to want to go to some place that they think might be safer, or if not for them, at least for their children. And that was part of the rationale that was sold to be able to convince people, and there was a great campaign to get the Eastern European Jews to move to Palestine that became Israel in May 1948. And as I say, the rest of it is history, and it's pretty bad, John, pretty bad. It certainly keeps me
writing off a lot. Yeah, but now, you see, what I'm doing is I want to take it one step deeper, okay? We had this war going on, since the Crusades or before, with Islam, and it's always been the West has always been defeated in that war. War after war after war, and we never conquered the Middle East. So then the First World War happened, and we had promised the Arabs all of these things, the British promised them to get their cooperation, and then of course the British, who were the greatest liars in all of history. What was it? Somebody said that the sun never sets upon the English Empire, and one Irishman said that's because God doesn't trust the newsmen in the dark. But you have really the British status quo, the power structure, the peers of Britain that rule that country, that they are the world's greatest liars that ever existed. We talk about can you trust the Syrians or can you trust the Iranians, and everybody around the world is saying, can you trust the British or the English or the Americans? And we're the ones that you can't trust. I mean, but anyhow, my point was that at the end of the First World War, the British wanted to continue this war against Islam. So they reneged on their promises to Arabs and cut the Middle East up into all sorts of protectorates, French and British protectorates. Well, that wasn't working out too good either. So they decided at the end of the Second World War to put an English colony in there, and the colonists would be Jews. And, it's just one more step in the westernization of the Arab race by British Americans in there, like in Western Europe. And even the Jews don't recognize this. They don't recognize that they're pawns for England. That, England had Palestine as a protectorate. It turned it over to the Jews, who kicked out the Palestinians. But the English are the ones, and their supporters, of course, like the Americans, are the ones who have kept the Jewish state alive in Palestine. And that aspect of the war on Islam would have collapsed a long time ago without that support from Western nations. It's just another instance of an age-old conflict between Western Christians and Middle Eastern Muslims. That's all it is. You can view it in all sorts of other ways, but at bottom, that's all it is.
John, it really is, and a great man. I wish was still living today. We just passed his 10th anniversary of his death, Edward Said. He talks so much about what you're discussing now, and he talked about that dichotomy between the Oriental world and the Western world, and he used terms like us, our superior people, us, for the Western people, like the Brits and the others, and the term them for the Oriental people, the Muslims and so on, referring to people who are inferior, and there's been this dichotomy going back, I don't know how long, through
centuries.
The ages, for so long.
Centuries. The Christians could never get over the fact that the land that Christ walked on was taken over by Muslims. So what? The land that Indians were taking off, walked on, were taken over by Englishmen. I mean, it's the way the world goes.
Well, maybe Christians can't get over the fact that Christ was Jewish.
Well, that's part of it, too. We can't get over that fact. I mean, and everybody thinks they're using everybody else. Like the American religious right that supports Israel's right, supposed right to exist. They only do it because they believe it's going to hasten the second coming, at which time Jews will all be exterminated. What a good buddy that is to have on your side.
I think they give them a choice, John. They can either these are the Christian fascists, the extreme ones. They have two choices. They can either convert to Christianity, or they'll perish.
Okay. So, isn't that a great ally to have?
It's a wonderful ally, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, and then I know what Netanyahu and people like him think. I don't know anything about what goes on in their minds. I mean, it's so ludicrous that the arguments that they put forth in support of their position are so ludicrous, so illogical that they're not worthy of a fifth grader. I don't believe that they believe them. They can't possibly believe them. Netanyahu can't possibly believe that stuff. He puts it forth thinking that we're going to believe it.
Well, John, you need a pretext to go after the goals that you seek, and the goal of Israel is to be the Middle East hegemon. No challenger to Israel's supremacy. So Israel got America to fight its Iraq war for it. There's a proxy war that's raging in Syria, and Israel very much is involved in that, and very much a partner with America. It's Obama's war in Syria, and Israel is a partner in that war, and five times this year, Israel has launched air attacks against Syria, and the only reason Syria hasn't responded is because then it would give Israel a pretext to expand the war and conduct more attacks, including ground forces, and that's the last thing that Syria wants. They want to extract themselves from this horror that they're going through, an invasion by these death squads that have been recruited by America, and the CIA is over there, and U.S. Special Forces are over there, and the whole story that people hear in the daily headlines, that when there are any, is completely false.
Yeah, sure. I mean, but that's part of a Western takeover, or a Western attempt to take over. And I predict it'll fail. Israel and America combined can't kill billions of Muslims.
That's right. They can't.
They just
it's
can't
impossible.
Do it. It's impossible. And to think that they can is so juvenile, so sophomoric, that it's hard to believe that anybody, is dumb enough to believe it.
They can win one Pyrrhic victory after another, John, and in the end they'll lose the war. And that's
every war we've fought since the Second World War.
America lost every war it waged after the Second World War. Hasn't won a single war, not in Korea.
Except Grenada, the Hollywood War.
Oh, Grenada. Was that a war, John?
Well, it's a Hollywood War.
That was a Hollywood War. Yes, I do remember that. Early 1980s, Ronald Reagan's invasion. That was Reagan's war. to protect some medical school students from construction workers building an airport or a runway that Cuba was involved in some way, as I remember the story. It was also a left-of-center government, and that was the real issue. Get rid of a left-of-center government and put in a right-wing extremist to replace it, and that was part of the dirty game. I mean, this stuff goes on all the time, and of course we have the Latin American wars at that time. Another big thing going on right now, John, is literally going on, as far as I know, as you and I are speaking. I don't think it's over yet, although there's certainly a time difference between us here and in Switzerland, where there are so-called Iranian nuclear talks taking place in Geneva.
Yeah.
Oh, I wrote about it yesterday. I wrote that was my second article yesterday on the current round that was supposed to be over tomorrow and last night, Friday night. Well, I've got another article coming tomorrow that I call Overtime in Geneva, because they continued the discussions and nothing is resolved. And despite all the high-minded rhetoric about, wonderful progress being made, it looks like a deal is being struck and maybe we can finally achieve what never has been achieved before. I don't believe a word of it, John.
I know. It's just like the Palestinian-Israelis peace talks.
Exactly. I call them the no peace talks.
No peace peace talks. Yeah. I mean, they're going to be. Kerry's going to Geneva to sabotage the talks. That's all there is to it.
And he's got lots of company. He's got the foreign ministers of France, of Germany, and then Russia, Sergei Lavrov showed up, and the Chinese vice chairman, something or other, and I forget his name. The Chinese names are so hard to remember and pronounce right, but he is either there now or he's on his way, so you'll have five foreign ministers in Geneva talking with the Iranians. The Iranian foreign minister is there. And the fix is in, John, to be sure there's no deal that will be equitable to solve this business. And the issue at hand has got nothing to do with Iran's nuclear program. That's a ruse. It's a red herring, and I've written lots about that topic. The real issue, same issue it was in Iraq, same issue in Syria, same reason in Afghanistan, same reason in Venezuela, same reason in other countries, sovereign independence, not controlled by America. And any nation that dares value its own sovereignty above the rights of America to dominate its policies, that regime gets, that government gets targeted for regime change, meaning America wants a puppet government replacing a sovereign independent one. And that's the key issue with Iran. Nobody talks about it. I repeat it over and over again in my articles, and I stress that the nuclear issue is simply a red herring. It's red herring cover for longstanding planned regime change, and America wants it either by, you know, getting Iraq to fold their tent and come over and say, we're sick and tired of all this business going on, so we'll go along with your policies. Well, Iran isn't going to do that. And the second choice is to try to assassinate its leaders. Well, so another one will replace the one assassinated. So that won't work. And the final option that I see coming at some point, which I call insanity, is a war against Iran, and that really would be insanity, because I think that would become a regional war, and a regional war could become a global war, and there's a name for that, John. It's called World War III, and if that ever happens, it's curtains.
Well, yeah, that's a possibility, and I think that analysis is right. The Western nations, especially the United States now, is the hegemon nation. Wants to control everything that happens. They already do it financially, pretty much, and the government has nothing to do with it. The government can't control the financiers either. So that's the way that capitalism works. It's a takeover. But I don't know what they're going to do with all their money when they have it. Nobody else has any to buy anything with there.
So true, John. There's a wonderful quote, and I don't have it in front of me, and I don't remember the exact words, but it goes something to the effect that, when all the people have been harmed so much and all the trees have died and all the water and air have been poisoned, then these bastards who are running the world today will discover that they can't eat money.
Yeah, that's right. You can't. I mean, especially the money that they have is fiat money. It's worthless as paper.
Exactly.
Once upon a time, wealth laid in the ownership of assets. Land, mining, farms. Nowadays, it lays in paper, and that paper can be made worthless in a second. And I don't know why they're not. Well, I know why they don't understand that. They're just dumb. That's all there is to it. They've got that bad intelligence that we've now made into a concept.
And when you print it madly, I call it money printing madness. It wouldn't be madness if it were used constructively, but it is not. It is used to stuff in the pockets of bankers so they can make more money. If you stuff it in the pockets of people, you could create jobs, you could grow the economy, but that's not what's being done. And there's one writer who refers to the fiat currency, the way it's madly printed, as toilet paper.
Yeah,
the U.S. currency is toilet paper.
Well, not only U.S. currency, the British pound is toilet paper, and euro is toilet paper. It's all toilet paper.
Oh, they print it the same. I think the Fed prints the most. They're printing trillions of dollars of toilet paper. I mean, nobody even knows how much because there's been a lot of money that's been sent overseas to help bail out the European banks, and nobody talks about this stuff. But I remember. citing the man who headed the TARP program back in 2008, Neil Barofsky. And again, nobody knows the exact numbers, but he tried to come up with some kind of an estimate, and he estimated that possibly as much, and he said this several years ago, possibly as much as something on the order of $23 trillion was created and supposedly loaned to bankers. Well, if it wasn't amount that much or anything close to that, what happened to that money? Was any of it paid back? Is it just forgotten? Is it sitting there? Is it being manipulated to make more money? $23 trillion? That's pretty heavy stuff, John.
Yeah, you know, it's a mad rush to make a collapsed system work. You know, I mean, I live in a part of the country where people quite often have to fix up old cars to make them work. And you'd be surprised at the things they'd go to make that old car work. And that's all that the Federal Reserve and any nation's finances in control of economists and bankers was an idiotic idea in the first place. But we can't do anything about that, can we?
Well, John, it's a crazy system. It's a system. I remember reading a book about Native Americans called Kill the Indian, Save the Man, a wonderful book. War Churchill wrote it. In the Fed program on all this money creation, you could call it Kill the Economy, Save the Banks. My definition of killing the economy would be, well, ordinary people, 23.5% of them don't have jobs. Almost 40% of the workforce that wants to work can't find one. There are tremendous levels of hunger and homelessness and deprivation in America. There's a Main Street depression going on, literally as bad, maybe even worse than back in the Great Depression when Roosevelt was creating jobs, putting people back to work, getting money in their pockets, cutting the employment rate. And now it's exactly the opposite, with ordinary people suffering so much. So it literally is killing the economy, except for the 1% that, they're laughing all the way to the bank, as they say. But ordinary people are really suffering, and nothing is getting better. It's getting worse. And who knows? I mean, there's a bad ending coming to this with the balloon that the bankers have blown up absolutely will pop at some point. And I dread what could happen when that happens. But literally, there could be a very serious problem in the country. Maybe the toilet paper money literally will be worthless at that point.
Yeah, you know, and that may be what is going to have to happen to get people to change these economic practices that we support. The total collapse of the economy, you know, we'll make people realize that this 12th century practices that we engage in don't work. I mean, and need to be changed.
John, I wonder what it will take to inflict enough pain on enough people to make them react and say, we're simply not going to take this anymore, and to do something about it other than thinking they can go to the ballot box and throw out the bums they don't like, because all they get are new bums.
Yeah, I mean that should be obvious to everyone that you don't get any change by changing politicians. Politicians are all cut from the same cloth. They may come in different colors, but it's all the same cloth.
It really is all the same cloth. And in America, there may be two parties with two different names, but America is and always has, not always. There were different parties way back, early 19th century and so on. But certainly in the last century and a half, America has been a one-party state, and there isn't a dime's worth of difference between Democrats and Republicans on the major issues mattering most. And people need to understand that. And money power runs everything. It's literally the power of money is the supreme power, and it's killing us.
Yeah, you know, it's red cloth and blue cloth, actually.
Yeah.
We even refer to it that by color nowadays. You know, we don't talk about Democratic or Republican states. We talk about red states and blue states. It's all the same cloth. It's all just dyed different color. That's all. Yeah. And it'll take it. Well, you could do it theoretically by if you had a way of making the press actually reveal, you know, the baseness of the political economic system, and name names and write articles every day, not once a month or whatever, but every day about, you know, a corrupt politician. I mean, we do it to the mayor of Toronto, who smokes crack. Okay, but we don't do it to the Supreme Court, whose crack is the status quo. You know, I mean, why isn't Judge Roberts ridiculed in the press and daily, not just once a year or once something, when they write an article about the court? I mean, write about him every day. I mean, this is ridiculous. You would think that a legal system would be one devoted to resolving issues. I mean, that's what's supposed to happen when two litigants come together in court. The issue between them is supposed to be resolved. The Supreme Court of the United States, for two centuries, has been involved in exacerbating the issues that comes before it.
John, they sure have. We are plumb out of time. I've got to interrupt you. You have certainly written some marvelous articles about the Supreme Court. Every now and then I take a whack at them, and there is nothing supreme about the Supreme Court. It is very unsupreme. John, I look forward to getting you back next month. It was terrific having you back. I've missed you so much. And I know my listeners have too. So we all thank you for coming today. And again, I'll send you an email when I get off the air. And I do look forward to having you back next month.
Yeah, we need to thank the engineer who showed up for Saturday.
all well that has ended well, John. Many, many thanks. I'll just send my end of program usual reminder to listeners. Join us again tomorrow. Back on again, same time, 1 p.m. Eastern Time, Saturdays, of course, this time, and Fridays at 11 a.m. Eastern Time. Make it a regular habit.